You ever stand on a carrier deck? I have not as Navy, mind you, I was just visiting. But I stood there and looked at that runway, if you can call it something that generous. And I thought to myself, there's no way a medium bomber rolls off this thing and lives. No way. And then I remembered that 80 men did exactly that on April 18, 1942, and I just shook my head. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is the Hangar on Radio Hangar. Pull up a chair because this one still gives me chills. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSold.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo private pilot, instrument rating all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSold.com. All right, let me set the stage. It is early 1942 and America is reeling. Pearl Harbor happened 4 months ago. Wake Island fell. The Philippines are falling. Bataan is a nightmare. The Japanese military looks unstoppable, and the American public is terrified. Morale is in the dirt, and President Roosevelt wants one thing. He wants to hit Tokyo. He wants to show Japan and the world that America can reach out and touch the home islands, no matter how far away they are. The problem is, nobody knows how to do it. Army bombers don't have the range to get there and back from any Allied base. Navy aircraft are too small to carry meaningful ordnance that far. And no carrier captain in his right mind is going to sail close enough to Japan to launch short-range planes. That's a suicide mission for the whole task force. So the idea lands on the desk of a man named Jimmy Doolittle. Now, if you don't know Doolittle, you should, because this man was already a legend before the raid ever happened. He was the first pilot to fly across the United States in under 24 hours. Back in 1922, he earned a doctorate in aeronautical engineering from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He won the Schneider Trophy, he won the Bendix Trophy, he won the Thompson Trophy. He was, without exaggeration, one of the finest pilots and sharpest aviation minds alive, and he was 45 years old when he volunteered to lead this mission personally. Here was the plan, and it was insane. Take 16 North American B-25 Mitchell medium bombers, load them onto the flight deck of the carrier USS Hornet. Sail within about 450 miles of Japan, launch the bombers, hit Tokyo, Yokohama, Nagoya, Kobe, and a few other targets. Then, since no B-25 on Earth can land on a carrier, the crews would fly on across the East China Sea and land at airfields in China. Think about what that means for a second. These were Army pilots. Most of them had never seen the ocean, let alone a carrier. They were going to take off in a twin-engine bomber that was designed to use runways of 4,000 feet or more, and they were going to roll off a deck that gave them about 467 feet. No catapult for the bombers, no arresting gear on the other end. One-way trip off that deck. Doolittle handpicked his crews, volunteers only, and every single man was told that the mission was extremely dangerous and that there was a real chance they would not come home. Not a single man dropped out. 80 aircrew divided among 16 airplanes. They trained at Eglin Field in Florida, practicing short field takeoffs on runways painted with the outline of a carrier deck. The Navy had calculated that with full flaps, engines at full power, and a headwind from the carrier's speed, the Mitchells could just barely stagger into the air. Just barely. That phrase should make your stomach tighten. They modified the B-25s to squeeze every possible mile out of them. Extra fuel tanks in the bomb bay, in the crawlway, in the turret area. They pulled the bottom turret guns to save weight. They replaced the tail guns with broomsticks painted black, a bluff, because every pound mattered when your runway was the length of a football field and a half. Now here's where it gets interesting, because the plan immediately went sideways. The Hornet and her escort, the carrier Enterprise, and a screen of cruisers and destroyers were supposed to get within about 400 miles of Japan before launching. That was the magic number. 400 miles meant the bombers had just enough fuel to reach those Chinese airfields. But on the morning of April 18th, about 670 miles out, a Japanese picket boat spotted the task force. The little patrol vessel got off a radio warning before the cruiser Nashville sank it. Admiral William Halsey, commanding the task force from the Enterprise, made the call, "Launch now." Every extra mile they waited was a mile closer to Japanese air and naval counterattack. So instead of launching at 400 miles, they launched at 668. That is 200 extra miles of ocean with no extra fuel to cover it. Every crew on every airplane knew what that math meant. They were probably not reaching China. Doolittle went first. His was the lead aircraft, and he had the shortest run of all. Right at the front of the deck, with about 467 feet of wood and steel between him and the Pacific Ocean. The Hornet was pitching in heavy seas. The deck crew timed his release to the upswing of a wave, and at 8:20 in the morning, Lieutenant Colonel Jimmy Doolittle pushed the throttles forward on his Mitchell, held the brakes until the engines were screaming, and let go. The airplane lumbered forward. You can see it in the old newsreel footage. It rolls and rolls and you think it's not going to make it, and then the bow drops away, and the Mitchell dips below the deck edge, and for one terrible heartbeat, the plane disappears. And then it climbs. Barely. But it climbs. One by one, 15 more Mitchells repeated that act of faith. Every single one got off the deck. No accidents, no aborts. 16 bombers in the air, and the Hornet immediately turned around and ran east at flank speed. The flight to Japan took about 5 hours. They came in low, wavetop low, to avoid detection. Imagine that. 5 hours skimming the ocean in a bomber loaded with extra fuel and live ordnance, knowing that if one engine coughs, you're going in the water and nobody is coming to get you. They hit their targets in the early afternoon. Doolittle's crew bombed a factory district in Tokyo. Other crews struck oil storage facilities, steel works, and military targets across four cities. The physical damage was modest. 13 crews dropped bombs. The other three dropped incendiary clusters. In the grand strategic picture, the Doolittle raid did not cripple Japan's war industry. But that was never really the point. The point was psychological, and it worked beyond anyone's wildest hopes. The Japanese military had promised the emperor and the people that the home islands were untouchable, and here were American bombers in broad daylight, dropping ordnance on Tokyo. The shock was enormous. Japan pulled back fighter squadrons from the front lines to defend the homeland. They accelerated the Midway operation, which stretched their forces thin and led directly to the decisive American naval victory at Midway just 6 weeks later. Historians will tell you the Doolittle raid changed the trajectory of the Pacific War, not because of the bombs, but because of the decisions Japan made in response to them. Now, the part of the story that doesn't get told enough. What happened to the crews after they dropped their bombs? With that extra 200 miles of ocean eating their fuel, none of the 16 bombers reached their planned airfields in China. Night fell. Weather closed in. Fuel gauges were bouncing on empty. Crew by crew, they made the hardest decision a pilot can make: bail out into the darkness over occupied China, or ditch the airplane in the ocean and hope someone finds you. 15 crews either bailed out or crash-landed in China. One crew diverted to the Soviet Union, where they were interned for over a year. Of the 80 men who launched that morning, 3 were killed in crash landings or bailouts, 8 were captured by the Japanese. Of those 8, 3 were executed, 1 died of maltreatment in prison. The remaining 4 endured 40 months of brutal captivity and survived the war. And the Chinese civilians who helped the surviving airmen escape? The Japanese military launched a retaliatory campaign through the Chinese provinces where the crews came down. They killed an estimated 250,000 Chinese civilians. A quarter of a million people punished for the kindness of sheltering American flyers. That part of the story deserves to be remembered too. Jimmy Doolittle, after bailing out of his bomber, landed in a rice paddy in the dark and was convinced the mission had been a failure. He'd lost all 16 airplanes. He fully expected to be court-martialed. Instead, he received the Medal of Honor from President Roosevelt. He went on to command the 12th Air Force in North Africa, and later the mighty 8th Air Force in Europe. He retired as a 3-star general and lived to be 96 years old. I think about those 80 men a lot. I think about what it takes to climb into an airplane knowing the math doesn't work, knowing the fuel won't get you home, knowing the runway is a joke and the ocean is real and the enemy is waiting. And doing it anyway because the mission matters more than the math. That's not recklessness, that's something else entirely. There's a restored B-25 Mitchell at the National Museum of the United States Air Force in Dayton, Ohio, if you ever want to stand next to one and feel how big these airplanes really were. And then imagine squeezing 16 of them onto a carrier deck. It'll make your head spin. Most of what I shared today comes from Carol Glein's book, The Doolittle Raid, and the first-hand accounts collected by the Doolittle Raiders Association before the last raider. Dick Cole, Doolittle's co-pilot, passed away in 2019 at the age of 103. That's the story. That's the hangar. Find us at radiohangar.com. Keep the old ones flying, and I'll see you next time.